always would. Then I said I loved you. You said that that was good. Girl, you made a promise. Said you'd never want me to go. Oh, no. In the end, giver, you took your love away from me. In the end, giver, took back the love you gave to me. Baby, I was feeling the way I wanna feel. You had me believing the love we had was real. Things we did together, you said they'd never end. Now until forever, oh yeah, that's what you said. Girl, when I was down, I knew that you would always be there. Oh yeah. In the end, giver, in the end, giver, you took your love away from me.
The Blue Fairy Book by Andrew Lang. The Yellow Dwarf. Once upon a time there lived a queen who had been the mother of a great many children, and of them all only one daughter was left, but then she was worth at least 1,000. Her mother, who, since the death of the king her father, had nothing in the world she cared for so much as this little princess, was so terribly afraid of losing her that she quite spoiled her. and never tried to correct any of her faults. The consequence was that this little person, who was as pretty as possible, and was one day to wear a crown, grew up so proud and so much in love with her own beauty that she despised everyone else in the world. The queen, her mother, by her caresses and flatteries, helped to make her believe that there was nothing too good for her. She was dressed almost always in the prettiest frocks, as a fairy, or as a queen going out to hunt, and the ladies of the court followed her, dressed as forest fairies. And to make her more vain than ever, the queen caused her portrait to be taken by the cleverest painters, and sent it to several neighboring kings with whom she was very friendly. When they saw this portrait, they fell in love with the princess, every one of them. But upon each it had a different effect. One fell ill, one went quite crazy, and a few of the luckiest set out to see her as soon as possible. But these poor princes became her slaves the moment they set eyes on her. Never has there been a gayer court. 20 delightful kings did everything they could think of to make themselves agreeable, and after having spent ever so much money in giving a single entertainment, thought themselves very lucky if the princess said, "That's pretty." All this admiration vastly pleased the queen. Not a day passed but she received 7,000 or 8,000 sonnets, and as many elegies, madrigals, and songs, which were sent her by all the poets in the world. All the prose and all the poetry that was written just then was about Bellissima, for that was the princess's name, and all the bonfires that they had were made of these verses, which crackled and sparkled better than any other sort of wood. Bellissima was already 15 years old, and every one of the princes wished to marry her. But not one dared say so. How could they, when they knew that any one of them might have cut off his head 5 or 6 times a day just to please her? And she would have thought it a mere trifle, so little did she care. You may imagine how hard-hearted her lovers thought her, and the queen, who wished to see her married, did not know how to persuade her to think of it seriously. "Bellissima," she said, "I do wish you would not be so proud. What makes you despise all these nice kings? I wish you to marry one of them, and you do not try to please me." "I am so happy," Bellissima answered. "Do leave me in peace, madam. I don't want to care for anyone." "But you would be very happy with any of these princes," said the queen, "and I shall be very angry if you fall in love with anyone who is not worthy of you." But the princess thought so much of herself that she did not consider any one of her lovers clever or handsome enough for her, and her mother, who was getting really angry at her determination not to be married, began to wish that she had not allowed her to have her own way so much. At last, not knowing what else to do, she resolved to consult a certain witch who was called the Fairy of the Desert. Now this was very difficult to do, as she was guarded by some terrible lions. But happily the queen had heard a long time before that whoever wanted to pass these lions safely must throw to them a cake made of millet flour, sugar candy, and crocodile's eggs. This cake she prepared with her own hands, and putting it in a little basket, she set out to seek the fairy. But as she was not used to walking far, she soon fell very tired and sat down at the foot of a tree to rest, and presently fell fast asleep. When she awoke, she was dismayed to find her basket empty. The cake was all gone, and to make matters worse, at that moment she heard the roaring of the great lions, who had found out that she was near and were coming to look for her. "What shall I do?" she cried. "I shall be eaten up." And being too frightened to run a single step, she began to cry, and leaned against the tree under which she had been asleep. Just then she heard someone say, She looked all around her, and then up the tree, and there she saw a little tiny man who was eating oranges. "Oh, queen," said he, "I know you very well, and I know how much afraid you are of the lions. And you are quite right, too. For they have eaten many other people. And what can you expect, as you do not have any cake to give them?
I must make up my mind to die, said the poor queen. Alas, I should not care so much if only my dear daughter were married.
Oh, you have a daughter, cried the yellow dwarf, who was so called because he was a dwarf, and had such a yellow face and lived in the orange tree. I'm really glad to hear that, for I've been looking for a wife all over the world. Now, if you will promise that she shall marry me, not one of the lions, tigers, or bears shall touch you. The queen looked at him and was almost as much afraid of his ugly little face as she had been of the lions before, so that she could not speak a word. What? You hesitate, madam? Cried the dwarf. You must be very fond of being eaten alive. And as he spoke, the queen saw the lions, which were running down a hill toward them. Each one had two heads, 8 feet, and 4 rows of teeth, and their skin was as hard as turtle shells, and were bright red. At this dreadful sight, the poor queen, who was trembling like a dove when it sees a hawk, cried out as loud as she could, "Oh, dear dwarf, Bellissima shall marry you." "Oh, indeed," he said disdainfully, "Bellissima is pretty enough, but I don't particularly want to marry her. You can keep her." "Oh, noble sir," said the queen in great distress, "do not refuse her. She is the most charming princess in the world." "Oh, well," he replied, "out of charity I will take her, but be sure and don't forget that she is mine." As he spoke, a little door opened in the trunk of the orange tree. In rushed the queen, only just in time, and the door shut with a bang in the faces of the lions. The queen was so confused that at first she did not notice another little door in the orange tree. But presently it opened, and she found herself in a field of thistles and nettles. It was encircled by a muddy ditch, and a little further on was a tiny thatched cottage, out of which came the yellow dwarf with a very jaunting air. He wore wooden shoes and a little yellow coat, and as he had no hair and very long ears, he looked altogether a shocking little object. "I am delighted," he said to the queen, "that as you are to be my mother-in-law, you should see the house in which your Bellissima will live with me. With these thistles and nettles she can feed a donkey which she can ride whenever she likes. Under this humble roof no weather can hurt her. She will drink the water of this brook and eat frogs which grow very fat about here. And then she will have me always with her, handsome, agreeable, and gay as you see me now. For if her shadow stands by her more closely than I do, I shall be surprised." The unhappy queen, seeing all at once what a miserable life her daughter would have with this dwarf, could not bear the idea, and fell down insensible without saying a word. When she revived, she found to her great surprise that she was lying in her own bed at home, and what was more, that she had on the loveliest lace nightcap that she had ever seen in her life. At first she thought that all her adventures, the terrible lions, and her promise to the yellow dwarf that he should marry Bellissima, must have been a dream. But there was the new cap with its beautiful ribbon and lace to remind her that it was all true, which made her so unhappy that she could neither eat, drink, nor sleep for thinking of it. The princess, who, in spite of her willfulness, really loved her mother with all her heart, and was much grieved when she saw her looking so sad, and often asked her what was the matter. But the queen, who didn't want her to find out the truth, only said that she was ill, or that one of her neighbors was threatening to make war against her. Bellissima knew quite well that something was being hidden from her, and that neither of these was the real reason of the queen's uneasiness. So she made up her mind that she would go and consult the fairy of the desert about it, especially as she had often heard how wise she was,
and she thought at the same time she might ask her advice as to whether it would be as well to be married or not. So, with great care, she made some of the proper cake to pacify the lions, and one night went up to her room very early, pretending that she was going to bed. But instead of that, she wrapped herself in a long white veil, and went down a secret staircase, and set off all by herself to find the witch.
man would meditate on this abnormal privilege, and that some moon found out he was a man of phenomenon. Not to be a man, to be a suggestion of another man's dream. Yes, an incredible humiliation. Any father is interested in the son he is so created or permitted out of the mere confusion of happiness. It was master of this. Is it the fear for the future of our family? We have built up anger by nature, future by future. Let's come to the mind this tonight. But just given the end of the day, but not without certain children. First, a feeling there.
Daniel X with Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q.
Daniel X Commander Q.
And spirit and all heaven, long heaven,
guest,
join
your guest, the world. 36 X with Commander
Q.
But when she got as far as that same fatal orange tree, and saw it covered with flowers and fruit, she stopped and began to gather some of the oranges. And then, putting down her basket, she sat down to eat them. But when it was time to go on again, the basket had disappeared. And though she looked everywhere, not a trace of it could she find. The more she hunted for it, the more frightened she got. And at last she began to cry. Then all at once she saw before her the yellow dwarf.
"What's the matter with you, my pretty one?" said he. "What are you crying about?" "Alas," she answered, "no wonder that I am crying, seeing that I have lost the basket of cake that was to help me get safely to the cave of the fairy of the desert."
"And what do you want with her, pretty one?" said the little monster.
"For I am a friend of hers, and for the matter of that, I am quite as clever as she is."
"The queen, my mother," replied the princess, "has lately fallen into such a deep sadness that I fear that she will die, and I am afraid that perhaps I am the cause of it, for she very much wishes me to be married, and I must tell you that as yet I have not found anyone I consider worthy to be my husband. So, for all these reasons, I wish to talk to the fairy."
"Do not give yourself any further trouble, princess," answered the dwarf. "I can tell you all you want to know better than she could,
The queen, your mother, has promised you in marriage.
Has promised me?
Interrupted the princess.
Oh, no. I'm sure she has not. She would have told me if she had.
I am too much interested in the matter for her to promise anything without my consent. You must be mistaken.
Beautiful princess,
cried the dwarf suddenly, throwing himself on her knees before her, I flatter myself that you will not be displeased at her choice when I tell you that it is to me she has promised the happiness of marrying you.
You, cried Bellissima, starting back, my mother wishes me to marry you? How can you be so silly as to think such a thing?
It isn't that I care much to have that honor, cried the dwarf angrily. But here are the lions coming. They'll eat you up in three mouthfuls, and there will be an end of you and your pride. And indeed, at that moment, the poor princess heard the dreadful howls coming nearer and nearer.
What shall I do? She cried. Must all my happy days come to an end like this?
The malicious dwarf looked at her and began to laugh spitefully. At least, said he, you have the satisfaction of dying unmarried. A lovely princess like you must surely prefer to die rather than be the wife of a poor little dwarf like myself.
Oh, don't be angry with me, cried the princess, clasping her hands. I'd rather marry all the dwarfs in the world than to die in this horrible way.
Look at me well, princess, before you give me your word, said he. I don't want you to promise me in a hurry.
Oh, cried she, the lions are coming. I have looked at you enough. I am so frightened. Save me this minute, or I shall die of terror.
Indeed, as she spoke, she fell down insensible, and when she recovered, she found herself in her own bed at home. How she got there, she could not tell, but she was dressed in the most beautiful lace and ribbons, and on her finger was a little ring, made of a single red hair, which fitted so tightly, try as she might, she could not get it off. When the princess saw all these things and remembered what had happened, she too fell into the deepest sadness, which surprised and alarmed the whole court, and the queen more than anyone else. 100 times she asked Bellissima if anything was the matter with her, but always she said that there was nothing. At last, the chief men of the kingdom, anxious to see the princess married, sent to the queen to beg her to choose a husband for her as soon as possible. She replied that nothing would please her better, but that her daughter seemed so unwilling to marry, and she recommended them to go and talk to the princess about it themselves. So this they at once did. Now Bellissima was much less proud since her adventure with the yellow dwarf, and she could not think of a better way of getting rid of the little monster than to marry some powerful king. Therefore she replied to their request much more favorably than they had hoped, saying that though she was very happy as she was, still, to please them, she would consent to marry the king of the gold mines. Now he was a very handsome and powerful prince, who had been in love with the princess for years, but had not thought that she would ever care about him at all. You can easily imagine how delighted he was when he heard the news, and how angry it made all the other kings to lose forever the hope of marrying the princess. But, after all, Bellissima could not have married 20 kings. Indeed, she had found it quite difficult enough to choose one, for her vanity made her believe that there was nobody in the world who was worthy of her. Preparations were begun at once for the grandest wedding that had ever been held at the palace. The king of the gold mines sent such immense sums of money that the whole sea was covered with ships that brought it. Messengers were sent to all the gayest and most refined courts, particularly of the court of France, to seek out everything rare and precious to adorn the princess, although her beauty was so perfect that nothing she wore could make her look prettier. At least that is what the king of the gold mines thought, and he was never happy unless he was with her. As for the princess, the more she saw of the king, the more she liked him. He was so generous, so handsome and clever, that at last she was almost as much in love with him as he was with her. How happy they were as they wandered about in the beautiful gardens together, sometimes listening to sweet music. And the king used to write songs for Bellissima. This is the one that she liked very much. In the forest all is gay when my princess walks that way. All the blossoms then are found downward fluttering to the ground, hoping she may tread on them and bright flowers on slender stem. Gaze up at her as she passes, brushing lightly through the grasses. Oh, my princess, birds above, echo back our songs of love, as through this enchanted land, blithe we wander hand in hand. They were really as happy as the day was long. All the king's unsuccessful rivals had gone home in despair. They said goodbye to the princess so sadly that she could not help being sorry for them.
Testing 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Thank you. Experiment around with some new vocals too.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah, right. And the voice is
keep it fresh.
Keep it fresh.
Keep it new. Rust never sleeps.
Thank you.
the next election. Stop the fuck spot to the heat on every march. No weapons of mass destruction around my lap. It's 2 weeks months people in Congress to scratch his back. We got 1,000 points of light from the ozone layer. We got toilet paper on my business. He don't care.
That third verse go?
1,000 points of light.
When homeless man, that was it. That was like at that first element.
Kinder, gentler
machine gun hand, yeah. What are those weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah.
Maybe I should try to play out in Plainville and try to turn out after that song. For the first verse.
Hey, there was a war protester in the middle of Plainville. It's
rushed.
Oh, well, that's true.
Don't have seen
it. No, no, no.
Alright, so I do that.
Want to read something? Yeah, well, I want you to play.
Right.
Want to read? Neil.
I'm Jerry. You got that picture for me, it's right. That's a good one. I did actually just lost these things. I got these for free, I think.
Free picks?
Yeah. So I'm going to take them to 63 millimeters. I think they're from now.
So that's like lighter than your...
Oh, heavier than yours.
Oh, much heavier, so they work well for you. Alright, okay. So I'm just going to read and you play and whatever.
Alright.
So you have to play...
Is it for me? What's this? Yeah, it's 63 millimeters. And the
okay.
Ones I play are like 46s.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you look around, this one might say on it. Well, it just says thin. But that broke the 46. It was on the floor somewhere. This is about... Maybe just about ethereal subjects that you just have to speak.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Then you start. Shudders briefly and again, lashes not as spectacle, dead rhythms kick for whatever convulse remains. Nothing true here, just days pricked for coins, call it a life, a passing carnival of blankness indeed. Something yet dances out there in the shade, stream stroke of a leaf, wing of a thigh, call her bitch, she responds. Bit of name unless you're on it. Kneel. Submit. Love's immolation. Liberation's ash. Wield the flame anew, call it music. Dancing power, roar with the night. Touch your feather, she responds. Touch your leather, she responds. Wake up, someone else's world is eating you, while she arcs and corrodes. A rampage, a terror, the night's flawless embrace, perpetual. King's broad minions, preacher's tome of knots, we listen and still slowly crack wide. The artist barks tunefully, rests later with cleanly brushed fur. Kneel, submit. Trees burn up in truth where men mew and flee for anywhere. My heart spits wildly for just a little content. Blood bounces through the streets again. Small things fall and lay open. Talk and song celebrate, lull, submit. Restless wonder finds no home. Convulse, drift. We want something, and something else. Desire, glare across the tone, wither of persistence. Empire relax. Casual tinkering is busy most. Life eaten, walking a path which does not arrive. A world crackling its news tonight by bullet, and feather, and spasm. Soft tightens around hard. Bubbles and shrieks vie for believers. Kings gallop over deserts a thousand centuries of forgetting. In dreams I am chimes you steal from market. The music in your satchel and scent. One heart dreaming another. Empire relax. Hark human noise ever burst out with melody or smoke. What great passes. What small lingers. What little coming reveals. Choked roaring with emptiness, ears mount and mock. The olden crumbles, retreats, reforms elsewise, presses harder on. The olden lives in tonight's kiss. Leaden blow, a rising thrust within a quiet wood, still felt by a far city staggering. Someone says quietly, we all share the same soul. In dreams I am your tinder, your scripture, your flu, conjuring me from hardly a parcel of words yet see me appear. Itching and bruised, you make me appear. Empire relax. All glory passeth, tomorrows and tomorrows and tomorrows too. The world remains surround king's winning horn and fullest of moons. The waiting dust of brother for brother. You conjure, I arise. Another path beckons. Empire relax. Telling strum, fail, raise and again, shriek for a swath of yesterday flesh, an angle receding, no magic can rightly trace, great eyes with brain cunning to a moment, where is it, new pilgrims ride on, join or be damned, it hurts, raise or dwindle. Sought singing light within shaped flesh, knowing's greater fury, open-thighed cry of bright meaning, among ancient branches of heat and wonder, a twist-making language, songs fruiting as languages bloom and bleed, giving drizzle sense and the invisible intent. You come now a careen of willows and wings, unclosed circle of despair, numb, twitch, numb. Convulsing small barks to return, someone, anyone, unto the moment blossom of touch, cease of wishings begging gnaw, this time she will stay, this time she will stay, this time she will stay. Hurry and limp toward shifting something, a life summing in songs and squalor. Radiant chants crossed by paths of ache, flashes of joy, her useless tap, this morning found me strumming again. Now chasing away, found by other creatures, or kind, less gritted than melody, a singing without divide, brutality left to sun and years, a cough of stars tonight, depressing noise the world offered as magic, to those quiet and intense enough to translate. She will stay, she will stay, she will stay. Someone, anything, will matter again.
I wanted to do this all. I gotta pick up Natalie at my folks' house, and then I gotta pick up Melinda's clothes and take them. I gotta assume role of I gotta go back.
Get to back to your father.
Father again, yeah. My Freno was that's very nice. Way I like this,
mm-hmm.
Especially the last one. I thought the title was
Kareem.
Kareem. That's why I kind of
Kareem.
Well, glad we finally got to jam. It only took us till mid-July.
Yeah, it only took us to mid-July. It only took me mid-July to get to Walden's to actually go out and do a tune and just meet somebody and finally bite the bullet and advise
them. And you have a jar of joy.
I have a jar of joy.
And a bag of joy.
Bag of joy.
That you have to hide from your progeny.
My offspring.
Your offspring. Well, you tell her directly from you and directly from me, do not ever bring anything
on
board.
I told her, if I haven't hammered at home, I made it very clear to her, if you get caught doing something, don't expect me to come all the way out to California to bail you out, because you're going to have to get out of yourself.
Just don't tell her, just tell her not to bring you.
Well, I did, I told her, I said, don't even think
go
of it.
Go clean.
I know, I told her, I said, don't even think of it. So, and she does, I said, you're crazy. I said, don't even think of it.
It's not worth it.
It's not. Excuse me. It's not. I told her. I said, whether you get caught in, don't come crying. I mean, obviously, first offense, being 17, they probably ship it home anyway, but still, right. it's the bottom line. So I told her.
Don't bring any. Go completely clean.
Any
paraphernalia.
She's going out.
Anything of any kind. Don't bring that fucking flashlight. Don't bring anything. Yeah, it's California. It's all there.
Well, don't tell her. My home car is here.
Oh, okay.
She left it on the floor with it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, you haven't given it back.
No.
You like the flash.
No, I'll be honest with you, I usually don't use a bowl. I mean, the people say you should use a bowl because you save the weed. In a way, it's true, but I mean, or a bowl, like, I mean, I took two hits off it. I think this weed is so potent, so powerful. That I know. But if I want to get high, I know, the problem is it's only in times when I have nothing to do. And it's really only times when both kids aren't around.
Which is your vacation?
Yeah,
which is
my vacation.
Which is next week.
Right, and
you're totally planning.
And I mean, after that, it's like, I go like now, I mean, that was the first talk I've had, and since, you know the last one was when we did it?
Yeah.
That was the last time, and the time before that. I mean,
yeah,
other, like
I
said, you're the only person I really hired.
I know.
There's really very few other people. Well,
motive
and
opportunity.
Yeah. Tomorrow is miniature golf day.
Good. I don't see any contradictory or irreconcilable differences between you playing guitar with your friends and then playing miniature golf the next day.
I think you've wrapped it up
in a nice bundle.
What time is it? You don't have to go to church. Don't worry about it. I don't leave the class. I do have to get on the stick. I told my mother, I'll be there in a while, Mom. I'm taking my time. And then I had a little talk with Natalie, and she wasn't too happy about me going. I said, I'm sorry, Natalie. I said, you're gonna have to understand. Man, I'm just finally. She has to get some kind of separation.
Yeah.
Because she's all 16. She's 15 now. She's almost 16.
Yeah.
And it's like she has to get some kind of separation.
Absolutely.
And just to realize that I'm not gonna always be here. I mean, one of these days I'm not gonna be in this world.
Right.
7:32.
No, 7:30. I gotta get going. That's a little off. All right. Your number is still over my phone's book, so it's fine. Now his song is just falling around, just chilling himself. What a beautiful man this is. This is what I'm cutting back on, is that I have to calorie-wise. As much as I love the beer. I'll tell you one thing, I save money to go. I have some wine at home. You know, I want a glass of wine, so if I really want the alcohol. I've been drinking less and less. First of all, I just can't justify going down to Butterfly.
Koi.
And Koi. Unless I declare bankruptcy. Koi. The damn place. COI.
Now you're
C. It's C-I.
Typo.
Yeah, no, you
want the typo that was caused on this course to be the advocate read by millions of readers.
Yeah, man. It's COI. COI.
It's like John
Boonstra,
if they were
friends
with Kirby,
however,
he had him,
he'd send you. I was telling right now, I know Tubby had Al Ray, and I see Boonstra, I see Suad.
Do you have a new editor? Like, I used to like Boonstra's poems.
I'll call up just for the hell of it and say, hey, Boonstra used to be, what was this guy changing his mind?
No, actually, you got to do the opposite.
No, yeah.
You don't call up and complain about a computer who's been there one day.
No, I won't.
You call up and say, man, all the fucking typos and crap, where'd it go? Did you actually hire a copy editor?
There you go. Oh, thank you.
Did you hire someone who knows their grammar? Doesn't call the fucking Apple key the squiggly key?
The squiggly key.
Mr. Master, I have to, I'm sorry. You have to do that thing again.
What does that mean? With your spirit, go with God, with your spirit. Sin all you want.
Go and sin no more.
Go and sin no more, but don't worry, you can confess them again when you're solved. That's the one thing I found.
Yeah, but in your defense, there are a lot of technical things that you don't actually refer to by the technical thing. You refer to by the people. Well, there's a big blue screen of death.
The big blue screen.
You don't say about the.
No, even I get that. Fatal error, never heard about it.
These are books.
Macintosh. They're good computers.
Macintosh. Ray, you ought to. I'll get a little issue with Macintosh. You want to work for them, do the commercials for them. Go.
Why don't you have all this time? I'll give you a pirate copy.
Make the smart decision.
Why?
Always. You know how the Sam Adams is? Always a smart decision.
$129.
They interviewed that guy on the Red Sox. They had him dressed up as Sam Adams. And mm-hmm. They interviewed him. And
who's your cook or the actor?
The actor that plays
Sam Adams. DSL Connection in OS-9.
Well, they listen to this now, so they got to play Sam Adams, and they interviewed him on the bass during the bass
part. Really?
And they so they said, well, Sam, what do you think of the Red Sox? Smart decision. And then they said, well, how are your suits tonight? Smart decision.
That's all the guy said. That's all he said.
Did they really have him?
Yeah, they really had him. That's all he said.
And then, listen,
this is a true story. No, they had him right there. They had him right there. And so he said, always a smart decision. And that's all he said like four or five times. And they said, okay. And they showed him right next to the announcer. It wasn't real. It was live.
Was he dressed up as Sam Adams?
He was dressed up as Sam Adams and everything. And then
This is on television.
This is
live.
I'm sitting there watching this. This is live. This is about a month ago. It's actually happening. I'm not through yet.
It gets weirder.
So about 5, 10 minutes later.
What did he say? Martha Adams, and he said smart decision.
Martha Adams. Smart decision.
€200
Between her legs, smart decision.
So
5, 10 minutes later, they spy him. He's up on the wall, one of the wall seats, the new wall seats, and he's got a beer in front of him. He takes it, you know. They're not supposed to show people drinking beer on TV. He's like this. They go back to him in a few minutes. He's drinking again. And then he realizes he waves to him.
Smart decision.
And then the announcers go, gee, I think Sam's had some beer tonight. And that's what was going on. The guy was plastered out of his brain. He's drinking Sam Adams. I guess they serve Sam Adams on the top of the wall. You know, or maybe it was down to the general population. He was shit-faced. He was shit-faced. It sure as hell wasn't like beer. He was shit-faced out of his mind.
Really?
He was. Yeah. It was a smart decision. He's like, all right, a smart decision. So smiling. Then by the time they showed him on the wall, it's like, you know, you can see him going, smart decision day.
Like, spitting beer. I don't know if this is the greatest publicity for Sam.
Oh, no. Jim Cook, when his first daughter was born, he gave her a smidgen of Sam Adams beer in the delivery room.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, and she had her 21st birthday in the Boston Brewery with a bunch of her friends.
All right, guys, I gotta get out of here. Bye, Jim.
Hello, Father Jim.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the keys are in the kitchen.
Nice, peace.
Had a very good time.
Thank you. That was very good.
Like, call somebody. I'm on my way.
Hey, Jim, thanks for driving and all this stuff.
No problem. Smart decision.
Was Sam Adams actually a drunk?
Huh?
He was a brewer patriot. Was he like brewer?
Hey, it's getting late. Where will you sleep? getting kind of hungry, but you forgot to bring something to eat.
Oh, lost, but no money, you start to cry.
But remember, you left home only to be grown, so dry your weeping eyes. About little boys running away from home, and the parents don't see them no more.
You wanna stop the hitch and run a home,
but your mama told you never trust a stranger, and you don't know which way to go. Streets are dark and deserted, not a sound, not sign of life. Oh, how you long to hear your mother's voice, 'cause you're lost and alone. Remember, you made the choice. Oh, run away, child, running wild. Better go back home where you belong. Hey, hey, run away, child, running wild. Better go back home where you belong. You're lost in this great big city.
Go back home.
36X Commander Q.
36XWIFI Commander Q.
36X Commander Q.
Commander Q. Strength. And spirit.
And
King of the gold mine said to her, "How is this? Why do you waste your pity on these princes, who love you so much that all their trouble would be well repaid by a single smile from you?"
"I should be sorry," answered Bellissima, "if you had not noticed how much I pitied these princes who were leaving me forever. But for you, sire, it is very different. You have every reason to be pleased with me, but they are going sorrowfully away, so you must not grudge them my compassion."
The king of the gold mines was quite overcome by the princess's good-natured way of taking his interference, and, throwing himself at her feet, he kissed her hand 1,000 times and begged her to forgive him. At last the happy day came. Everything was ready for Bellissima's wedding. The trumpets sounded. All the streets of the town were hung with flags and strewn with flowers, and the people ran in crowds to the great square before the palace. The queen was so overjoyed that she had hardly been able to sleep at all, and she got up before it was light to give the necessary orders and to choose the jewels that the princess was to wear. These were nothing less than diamonds, even to her shoes, which were covered with them. And her dress of silver brocade was embroidered with 12 of the sun's rays. You may imagine how much these had cost, but then nothing could have been more brilliant except the beauty of the princess. Upon her head she wore a splendid crown, her lovely hair waved nearly to her feet, and her stately figure could easily be distinguished among all the ladies who attended her. The king of the gold mines was not less noble and splendid. It was easy to see by his face how happy he was, and everyone who went near him returned loaded with presents. For all around the great banqueting hall had been arranged 1,000 barrels full of gold, and numberless bags made of velvet embroidered with pearls and filled with money, each one containing at least 100,000 gold pieces, which were given away to everyone who liked to hold out his hand, which numbers of people hastened to do, you may be sure. Indeed, some found this by far the most amusing part of the wedding festivities. The queen and the princess were just ready to set out with the king, when they saw, advancing toward them from the end of the long gallery, 2 great basilisks, dragging after them a very badly made box. Behind them came a tall old woman, whose ugliness was even more surprising than her extreme old age. She wore a ruff of black taffeta, a red velvet hood, and a farthingale all in rags, and she leaned heavily upon a crutch. The strange old woman, without saying a single word, hobbled 3 times round the gallery, followed by the basilisks, and then stopping in the middle and brandishing her crutch threateningly, she cried, "Ho, ho, queen! Ho, ho, princess! Do you think you are going to break with impunity the promise that you made to my friend the Yellow Dwarf? I am the fairy of the desert. Without the Yellow Dwarf and his orange tree, my great lions would soon have eaten you up, I can tell you. And in fairyland we do not suffer ourselves to be insulted like this. Make up your minds at once what you will do, for I vow that you shall marry the Yellow Dwarf. If you don't, may I burn my crutch."
"Ah, princess," said the queen, weeping, "what is this that I hear? What have you promised?"
"Ah, my mother," replied Bellissima sadly, "what did you promise yourself?" The king of the gold mines, indignant at being kept from his happiness by this wicked old woman, went up to her and, threatening her with his sword, said, "Get away out of my country at once, and forever, miserable creature, lest I take your life and so rid myself of your malice." He had hardly spoken these words when the lid of the box fell back on the floor with a terrible noise, and to their horror out sprang the Yellow Dwarf, mounted upon a great Spanish cat. "Rash youth," he cried, rushing between the fairy of the desert and the king, "dare to lay a finger on this illustrious fairy? Your quarrel is with me only. I am your enemy and your rival. That faithless princess, who would have married you, is promised to me. See if she has not upon her finger a ring made of one of my hairs. Just try to take it off, and you will soon find out that I am more powerful than you are." "Wretched little monster," said the king, "do you dare to call yourself the princess's lover and to lay claim to such a treasure? Do you know that you are a dwarf, that you are so ugly that one cannot bear to look at you, and that I should have killed you myself long before this if you had been worthy of such a glorious death?" The Yellow Dwarf, deeply enraged at these words, set spurs to his cat, which yelled horribly and leaped hither and thither, terrifying everybody except the brave king, who pursued the dwarf closely till he, drawing a great knife with which he was armed, challenged the king to meet him in single combat, and rushed down to the courtyard of the palace with a terrible clatter. The king, quite provoked, followed him hastily, but they had hardly taken their places facing one another, and the whole court had only just had time to rush out upon the balconies to watch what was going on, when suddenly the sun became red as blood, and it was so dark that they could scarcely see at all. The thunder crashed, and the lightning seemed as if it must burn up everything. The 2 basilisks appeared, one on each end of the bad dwarf, like giants, mountains high, and fire flew from their mouths and ears until they looked like flaming furnaces. None of these things could terrify the noble young king, and the boldness of his looks and actions reassured those who were looking on, and perhaps even embarrassed the Yellow Dwarf himself,
but even his courage gave way when he saw what was happening to his beloved princess. For the fairy of the desert, looking more terrible than before, mounted upon a winged griffin, and with long snakes coiled round her neck, had given her such a blow with the lance she carried that Bellissima fell into the queen's arms bleeding and senseless. Her fond mother, feeling as much hurt by the blow as the princess herself, uttered such piercing cries and lamentations that the king, hearing them, entirely lost his courage and presence of mind. Giving up the combat, he flew toward the princess to rescue her or die with her. But the yellow dwarf was too quick for him. Leaping with the Spanish cat upon the balcony, he snatched Bellissima from the queen's arms, and before any of the ladies of the court could stop him, he had sprung upon the roof of the palace and disappeared with his prize. The king, motionless with horror, looked on despairingly at this dreadful occurrence, which he was quite powerless to prevent. And to make matters worse, his sight failed him. Everything became dark, and he felt himself carried along through the air by a strong hand. This new misfortune was the work of the wicked fairy of the desert, who had come with the yellow dwarf to help him carry off the princess, and had fallen in love with the handsome young king in the gold mines directly she saw him. She thought that if she carried him off to some frightful cavern and chained him to a rock, then the fear of death would make him forget Bellissima and become her slave. So, as soon as they reached the place, she gave him back his sight, but without releasing him from his chains, and by her magic power she appeared before him as a young and beautiful fairy, and pretended to have come there quite by chance. "What do I see?" she cried. "Is it you, dear prince? What misfortune has brought you to this dismal place?" The king, who was quite deceived by her altered appearance, replied, "Alas, beautiful fairy, the fairy who brought me here first took away my sight, but by her voice I recognized her as the fairy of the desert, though what she should have carried me off for I cannot tell you." "Ah," cried the pretended fairy, "if you have fallen into her hands, you won't get away until you have married her. She has carried off more than one prince like this, and she will certainly have anything she takes a fancy to." While she was thus pretending to be sorry for the king, he suddenly noticed her feet, which were like those of a griffin, and knew in a moment that this must be the fairy of the desert, for her feet were the one thing she could not change, however pretty she might make her face. Without seeming to have noticed anything, he said in a confidential way, "Not that I have any dislike for the fairy of the desert, but I really cannot endure the way in which she protects the yellow dwarf and keeps me chained here like a criminal. It is true that I love a charming princess, but if the fairy should set me free, my gratitude will oblige me to love her only." "Do you really mean what you say, prince?" said the fairy, quite deceived. "Surely," replied the prince, "how could I deceive you? You see, it is so much more flattering to my vanity to be loved by a fairy than by a simple princess. But even I am dying of love for her. I shall pretend to hate her until I am set free." The fairy of the desert, quite taken in by these words, resolved at once to transport the prince to a pleasanter place. So making him mount her chariot, to which she had harnessed swans instead of the bats which generally drew it, away she flew with him. But imagine the distress of the prince when, from the giddy height at which they were rushing through the air, he saw his beloved princess in a castle built of polished steel, the walls of which reflected the sun rays so hotly that no one could approach it without being burned to a cinder. Bellissima was sitting in the thicket by a brook, leaning her head upon her hand and weeping bitterly. But just as they passed, she looked up and saw the king and the fairy of the desert. Now the fairy was so clever that she could not only seem beautiful to the king, but even the poor princess thought her the most lovely being that she had ever seen. "What?" she cried. "Was I not unhappy enough in this lonely castle, to which that frightful yellow dwarf brought me? Must I also be made to know that the king of the gold mines ceased to love me as soon as he lost sight of me? But who can my rival be, whose fatal beauty is greater than mine?" While she was saying this, the king, who really loved her as much as ever, was feeling terribly sad at being so rapidly torn away from his beloved princess. But he knew too well how powerful the fairy was to have any hope of escaping from her except by great patience and cunning. The fairy of the desert had also seen Bellissima, and she tried to read in the king's eyes the effect that this unexpected sight had had upon him. "No one can tell you what you wish to know better than I can," said he. "This chance meeting with an unhappy princess for whom I once had a passing fancy, before I was lucky enough to meet you, has affected me a little, I admit. But you are so much more to me than she is, that I would rather die than leave you." "Ah, prince," she said, "can I believe that you really love me so much?"
"Time will show, madam," replied the king. "But if you wish to convince me that you have some regard for me, do not, I beg of you, refuse to aid Bellissima."
"Do you know what you are asking?" said the fairy of the desert, frowning and looking at him suspiciously. "Do you want me to employ my art against the yellow dwarf, who is my best friend, and take away from him a proud princess, whom I can but look upon as a rival?" The king sighed, but made no answer. Indeed, what was there to be said to such a clear-sighted person?
Oh, oh, oh. It works. I had the pause button on.
Oh,
okay.
Infamous pause. So maybe your batteries are fine.
They might be.
Okay. My name is Judy, and I'm here with Ray Soulard Jr., the famous poet. Listen to the jasmine. Harmonica angel. Do it again, harmonica angel, sing those blues. Cry your sweet breath in gospel chords. Embrace the organ, grind my soul. Hold me again, harmonica angel, croon my heart. Stroke the clouds dry with heaven's tears. Harmonize life. Kiss me whole. If Rambo could samba. If Rambo could samba, purple amethyst would rhyme. Grapes would ferment in roaring acid speed. Jungles would toss out Ginsberg ginseng. If Rambo could samba, life would time machine sideways. Thoughts of music would seaweed our glances. Islands would shake in desertion. If Flambeau could samba, I'd dance to your beckoning. Rhythm and beat would laugh at our merriment. Distance would melt at our smile. If Flambeau, if only Flambeau would samba, if absinthe would pour from our memories, if oaken barrels would offer us love, oh then and then I'd embrace you in real time. I'd jump over equator lines. We'd harmonize the sunset of stillness and jive to perpetual joy. Sitfar, sitar. Sari slips off the shoulder. Sitfar, sitar. Dance in barefoot gesture. Twist hand, speak eye. Tabla, tabletop. Hair flies, arms rise. Dance, knees open as mountain sighs. Sit far, sitar boggles wonder. A stroke, a turn, bindi binds her. Pose, shanti, kick. Sit, satin blush, music rush. Sit far, sitar. 1 minute. Listen to the jasmine. As sundown sings its low notes, we listen to the jasmine. Coffee gentle with cardamom, finger strokes of twilight. A pause to sip as earth evolves. Treetops toll to meteors. Neptune nudges nearer. Our feet breathe the cosmic hush.
With Commander Q.
Of Atlantis was an island which lay before the great flood in the area we now call the Atlantic Ocean. So great an area of land that from her western shores those beautiful sailors journeyed to the south and the North Americas with ease in their ships with painted sails. To the east, Africa was her neighbor, across a short strait of sea miles. The great Egyptian age is but a remnant of the Atlantean culture. The antediluvian kings colonized the world. All the gods who play in the mythological dramas, in all legends from all lands, were from fair Atlantis. Knowing her fate, Atlantis sent out ships to all corners of the earth. On board were the 12. The poet, the physician, the farmer, the scientist, the magician, and the other so-called gods of our legends, though gods they were. And as the elders of our time choose to remain blind, let us rejoice and let us sing and dance and ring in the new. Hail Atlantis!
Way down below the ocean, where I wanna be, she may be. Way down below the ocean, where I wanna be, she may be. Way down below.
At last they reached a vast meadow, gay with all sorts of flowers. A deep river surrounded it, and many little brooks murmured softly under the shady trees, where it was always cool and fresh. A little way off stood a splendid palace, the walls of which were of transparent emeralds. As soon as the swans, which drew the fairy's chariot, had alighted under a porch, which was paved with diamonds and had arches of rubies, they were greeted on all sides by thousands of beautiful beings, who came to meet them joyfully, singing these words: "When love within a heart would reign, useless to strive against him 'tis. The proud but feel a sharper pain, and make a greater triumph his." The fairy of the desert was delighted to hear them sing of her triumphs. She led the king into the most splendid room that can be imagined, and left him alone for a little while, just that he might not feel that he was a prisoner. But he felt sure that she had not really gone quite away, but was watching him from some hiding place. So walking up to a great mirror, he said to it, "Trusty counselor, let me see what I can do to make myself agreeable to the charming fairy of the desert, for I can think of nothing but how to please her." And he at once set to work to curl his hair, and seeing upon a table a grander coat than his own, he put it on carefully. The fairy came back so delighted that she could not conceal her joy. "I am quite aware of the trouble you have taken to please me," said she, "and I must tell you that you have succeeded perfectly already. You see, it is not difficult to do if you really care for me." The king, who had his own reasons for wishing to keep the old fairy in a good humor, did not spare pretty speeches, and after a time he was allowed to walk by himself upon the seashore. The fairy of the desert had, by her enchantments, raised such a terrible storm that the boldest pilot would not venture out in it, so she was not afraid of her prisoners being able to escape, and he found it some relief to think sadly over his terrible situation, without being interrupted by his cruel captor. Presently, after walking wildly up and down, he wrote these verses upon the sand with his stick: "At last may I upon this shore lighten my sorrow with soft tears. Alas, alas, I see no more my love who yet my sadness cheers. And thou, O raging stormy sea, stirred by wild winds from depth to height, thou holdest my loved one far from me, and I am captive to thy might. My heart is still more wild than thine, for fate is cruel unto me. Why must I thus in exile pine? Why is my princess snatched from me? O lovely nymphs from ocean caves, who know how sweet true love may be, come up and calm the furious waves, and set my desperate lover free." While he was still writing, he heard a voice which attracted his attention in spite of himself. Seeing that the waves were rolling in higher and higher, he looked all around and presently saw a lovely lady floating gently toward him upon the crest of a huge billow. Her long hair spread all about her. In one hand she held a mirror, and in the other a comb. And instead of feet, she had a beautiful tail like a fish, with which she swam. The king was struck dumb with astonishment at this unexpected sight. But as soon as she came within speaking distance, she said to him, "I know how sad you are at losing your princess, and being kept a prisoner by the fairy of the desert. If you like, I will help you to escape from this fatal place, where you may otherwise have to drag on a weary existence for 30 years or more." The king of the gold mines hardly knew what answer to make to this proposal. Not because he did not wish very much to escape, but he was afraid that this might be only another device by which the fairy of the desert was trying to deceive him. As he hesitated, the mermaid, who guessed his thoughts, said to him, "You may trust me, I am not trying to entrap you. I am so angry with the yellow dwarf and the fairy of the desert that I am not likely to wish to help them, especially since I constantly see your poor princess
whose beauty and goodness make me pity her so much. And I tell you that if you will have confidence in me, I will help you to escape." "I trust you absolutely," cried the king, "and I will do whatever you tell me. But if you have seen my princess, I beg of you to tell me how she is and what is happening to her." "We must not waste time in talking," said she. "Come with me, and I will carry you to the Castle of Steel, and we will leave upon this shore a figure so like you that even the fairy herself will be deceived by it." So saying, she quickly collected a bundle of seaweed, and blowing it 3 times, she said, "My friendly seaweeds, I order you to stay here stretched upon the sand until the fairy of the desert comes to take you away." And at once the seaweeds became like the king, who stood looking at them in great astonishment, for they were even dressed in a coat like his, but they lay there pale and still as the king himself might have lain if one of the great waves had overtaken him and thrown him senseless upon the shore. And then the mermaid caught up the king, and away they swam joyfully together. "Now," said she, "I have time to tell you about the princess. In spite of the blow which the fairy of the desert gave her, the yellow dwarf compelled her to mount behind him upon his terrible Spanish cat. But she soon fainted away with pain and terror, and did not recover till they were within the walls of his frightful castle of steel. Here she was received by the prettiest girls it was possible to find, who had been carried there by the yellow dwarf, who hastened to wait upon her and showed her every possible attention. She was laid upon a couch covered with cloth of gold, embroidered with pearls as big as nuts." "Ah," interrupted the king of the gold mines, "if Bellissima forgets me and consents to marry him, I shall break my heart." "You need not be afraid of that," answered the mermaid. "The princess thinks of no one but you, and the frightful dwarf cannot persuade her to look at him." "Pray go on with your story," said the king. "What more is there to tell?" replied the mermaid. "Bellissima was sitting in the wood when you passed, and saw you with a fairy of the desert, who was so cleverly disguised that the princess took her to be prettier than herself. You may imagine her despair, for she thought that you had fallen in love with her." "She believes that I love her?" cried the king. "What a fatal mistake! What is to be done to undeceive her?" "You know best," answered the mermaid, smiling kindly at him. "When people are in as much love as one another as you two are, they don't need advice from anyone else." As she spoke, they reached the Castle of Steel, the side next to the sea being the only one which the yellow dwarf had left unprotected by the dreadful burning walls. "I know quite well," said the mermaid, "that the princess is sitting by the brookside, just where you saw her as you passed. But as you will have many enemies to fight with before you can reach her, take this sword. Armed with it, you may dare any danger and overcome the greatest difficulties. Only beware of one thing, that is, never to let it fall from your hand. Farewell. Now I will wait by that rock, and if you need my help in carrying off your beloved princess, I will not fail you, for the queen, her mother, is my best friend, and it was for her sake that I went to rescue you." So saying, she gave to the king a sword made of a single diamond, which was more brilliant than the sun. He could not find words to express his gratitude, but he begged her to believe that he fully appreciated the importance of her gift, and would never forget her help and kindness. We must now go back to the fairy of the desert. When she found that the king did not return, she hastened out to look for him, and reached the shore with 100 of the ladies of her train, loaded with splendid presents for him. Some carried baskets full of diamonds, other golden cups of wonderful workmanship, and amber, coral, and pearls. Others, again, balanced upon their heads bales of the richest and most beautiful stuffs, while the rest brought fruit and flowers and even birds. But what was the horror of the fairy, who followed this gay troop, when she saw, stretched upon the sands, the image of the king which the mermaid had made with the seaweeds. Struck with astonishment and sorrow, she uttered a terrible cry, and threw herself down beside the pretended king, weeping and howling and calling upon her 11 sisters, who were also fairies, who came to her assistance. But they were all taken in by the image of the king, for clever as they were, the mermaid was still cleverer. And all they could do was to help the fairy of the desert to make a wonderful monument over what they thought was the grave of the king of the gold mines. But while they were collecting jasper and porphyry, agate and marble, gold and bronze, statues and devices to immortalize the king's memory, he was thanking the good mermaid and begging her still to help him, which she graciously promised to do as she disappeared. And then he set out for the castle of steel. He walked fast, looking anxiously round him, and longing once more to see his darling Bellissima. But he had not gone far before he was surrounded by 4 terrible sphinxes, who would very soon have torn him to pieces with their sharp talons, if it had not been for the mermaid's diamond sword. For no sooner had he flashed it before their eyes, then down they fell at his feet quite helpless, and he killed them with one blow. But he had hardly turned to continue his search when he met 6 dragons covered with scales that were harder than iron. Frightful as this encounter was, the king's courage was unshaken, and by the aid of his wonderful sword he cut them in pieces one after the other. Now he hoped his difficulties were over, but at the next turning he was met by one which he did not know how to overcome. 24 pretty and graceful nymphs advanced toward him, holding garlands of flowers, with which they barred the way. "Where are you going, prince?" they said. "It is our duty to guard this place, and if we let you pass, great misfortunes will happen to you and us. We beg you not to insist upon going on. Do you want to kill 24 girls who have never displeased you in any way?" The king did not know what to do or to say, but as he hesitated, a voice in his ear said, "Strike, strike, and do not spare, or your princess is lost forever." So, without reply to the nymphs, he rushed forward instantly, breaking the garlands and scattering them in all directions, and then went on without further hindrance to the little wood where he had seen Bellissima. She was seated by the brook, looking pale and weary when he reached her, and he would have thrown himself down at her feet, but she drew herself away from him with as much indignation as if he had been the yellow dwarf. "Ah, princess," he cried, "do not be angry with me. Let me explain everything. I am not faithless or to blame for what has happened. I am a miserable wretch who has displeased you without being able to help myself." "Ah," cried Bellissima, "did I not see you flying through the air with the loveliest being imaginable? Was that against your will?" "Indeed it was, princess," he answered. "The wicked fairy of the desert, not content with chaining me to a rock, carried me off in her chariot to the other end of the earth, where I should even now be a captive but for the unexpected help of a friendly mermaid, who brought me here to rescue you, my princess, from the unworthy hands that hold you. Do not refuse the aid of your most faithful lover." So saying, he threw himself at her feet and held her by her robe. But alas, in so doing he let fall the magic sword, and the yellow dwarf, who was crouching behind a lettuce, no sooner saw it than he sprang out and seized it, well knowing its wonderful power. The princess gave a cry of terror on seeing the dwarf, but this only irritated the little monster. Muttering a few magical words, he summoned 2 giants who bound the king with great chains of iron. "Now," said the dwarf, "I am master of my rival's fate, but I will give him his life and permission to depart unharmed, if you, princess, will consent to marry me." "Let me die 1,000 times rather," cried the unhappy king. "Alas," cried the princess, "must you die? Could anything be more terrible?" "That you should marry that little wretch would be far more terrible," answered the king. At least, continued she, let us die together. Let me have the satisfaction of dying for you, my princess, said he. Oh, no, no, she cried, turning to the dwarf, rather than I will do as you wish. Cruel princess, said the king, would you make my life horrible to me by marrying another before my eyes? Not so, replied the yellow dwarf. You are a rival of whom I am too much afraid. You shall not see our marriage. So saying, in spite of Bellissima's tears and cries, he stabbed the king to the heart with a diamond sword. The poor princess, seeing her lover lying dead at her feet, could no longer live without him. She sank down by him and died of a broken heart. So ended these unfortunate lovers, whom not even the mermaid could help, because all the magic power had been lost with the diamond sword. As for the wicked dwarf, he preferred to see the princess dead rather than married to the king of the gold mines, and the fairy of the desert, when she heard of the king's adventures, pulled down the grand monument which she had built, and was so angry at the trick that had been played her, that she hated him as much as she had loved him before. The kind mermaid, grieved at the sad fate of the lovers, caused them to be changed into two palm trees, which stand always side by side, whispering together of their faithful love, and caressing one another with her interlacing branches.